While he is willing to engage, they should not expect him to be weak on security.
South Korea's new president helps define regional strategy. It's Friday, May 19th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you as well to check us out on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, the beneficiaries of China's Belt and Road Plan. Calls to release jailed Lao migrants. We meet a dreamer from China. Healthy vaping and a special birthday. All on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump is reported to have told a South Korean envoy he is willing to engage with North Korea to defuse tensions over its nuclear and missile programs, but only if the conditions are right. The South Korean Yonhap News Agency said Mr. Trump told the diplomat during a 10-minute meeting he won't hold talks for the sake of talks. The envoy carried with him a letter from new President Moon Jae-in as part of preparations for a planned summit between the two leaders in late June. He also discussed the newly deployed U.S. THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. Both President Moon and China have been critical of the deployment. North Korea on Sunday conducted its latest ballistic missile test in defiance of U.N. Security Council resolutions. Pyongyang said it was designed to carry a large-size, heavy nuclear warhead. Korea Economic Institute analyst Troy Stangerone tells VOA's Victor Beatty the new U.S. and South Korean administrations are trying to formulate a joint policy approach toward the North.
There are things that I think Moon Jae-in has put forward, such as family reunions, having the North Koreans attend the Winter Olympics in 2018 in South Korea. And I think these are things that the administration could and should support. But I think right now we're still in an early stage to where both governments are trying to create space for each other.
Do you sense any interest on the part of Pyongyang to engage in dialogue?
We've heard some rhetorical comments. They, much as everyone else, have said that under the right conditions, no one has really got into what these right conditions are. But I think if we look at their behavior so far, it's difficult to see them really coming seriously to the table. Clearly, we should leave that option open. But when they continue to test at a pace of basically one missile test a month or so, I think it's hard to conclude that they're willing to come to talks.
South Korea's president on Wednesday said there was a high possibility of conflict with North Korea. What do you make of his comments just hours after his administration said it was interested in opening communication links with the North?
President Moon is trying to signal to the North that while he is willing to engage, they should not expect him to be weak on security. He's talked in the campaign, and one of his pledges is to essentially take and significantly increase defense spending to improve, while not necessarily through the THAAD system, South Korea's missile defense. And I think this is something North Korea should take seriously, that while South Korea is willing to find other paths, they will not sacrifice their security for those paths.
And what do you make of the experts who are, to a varying degree, saying that the North is perfecting its capability to launch a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile?
I think that's clear. The only reason for the continuous tests is if you are trying to take and proceed as quickly as possible to perfecting a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile. We already presume that in the intermediate range that they have achieved this, but it's the intercontinental range that they still need to do testing on. And if we were to look at North Korea's own patterns, if this was simply a question of them trying to gain the world's attention or to take and move into talks to gain some temporary concessions before they go back again, that's not the case. We've all demonstrated that, you know, we're not going to do that, and the North Koreans have demonstrated that they're clearly trying to advance the program. I think when we look at this in terms of either trying to sort of predict tests or wonder if there's other reasons for this, that we're really doing a disservice by not focusing on what clearly they're doing, which is to try and advance the program as quickly as they can.
Meanwhile, President Moon's envoy to China arrived in Beijing Thursday to discuss a possible South Korean-China summit as early as July. That would come on the sidelines of a Group of 20 meeting in Germany. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are trending on VOAnews.com. Building collapse in Sri Lanka capital, injures 19. South Korea wants to reopen comfort women wound with Japan. India campaign to teach 5 million children about sex abuse. Rights groups condemn harsh prison sentence against Lao workers. China sees trade summit raising global status. Others see missed opportunities. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more when you visit our VOA Asia Facebook page and our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. As China hails the success of its first Belt and Road Summit, major powers remain skeptical about the $1 trillion infrastructure and trade project. Analysts say while the ambitious plan has whet the appetite of developing nations, China missed an opportunity to get developed countries on board. The fact that China could get the leaders of the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and the United Nations, along with 29 heads of state, to sign a communique is a triumph for Beijing, albeit symbolic, says Ethan Kramer Flood, associate director for the Conference Board's China Center for Economics and Business.
Is it a signal of genuine economic cooperation, or is it anything as significant like a free trade negotiation where new policies are going to emerge from this document? No, certainly not, right? It is, of course, a statement of intent.
That intent was borne out by the use of bland phrases such as encouraging, enhancing, and promoting, which showed up 16 times in the document. Jan Gasper is a China analyst at the Mercator Institute for China Studies, or MERICS, says the document is loaded with references to UN-related issues and appears to have been prepared beforehand, giving participants little opportunity to participate in its wording.
This was an opportunity to create, on the one hand, greater institutionalization of the initiative, which I think is very important, especially to Western countries, on the one hand. And on the other hand, it was also an opportunity to create greater stakeholder buy-in.
Analysts like Ethan Kramer Floyd say participants found common ground on issues such as finance, but the document on free trade was the one that faced the most headway.
Certain Western principles and values that some of the European countries wanted to insert were rejected either by the Chinese side or by not just China. I mean, I'm hearing talk of Russia and Turkey as well. They just weren't able to get aligned on that wording.
Wording and principles aside, it is mostly about getting a share of business. Christopher Balding, a professor at Peking University's HSBC Business School, says Beijing has made it exceedingly clear the Belt and Road will be a China-focused project that will openly favor Chinese firms. Later this year, China hosts a once-in-five-year leadership reshuffle, and raising the country's internal profile is crucial for President Xi Jinping as he works to consolidate power within the party.
This is essentially what amounts to an election year in China, and so this is something I think a lot of people have overlooked is the importance of how this plays domestically in bolstering Xi Jinping and the party's image.
Jan Gasper said the meeting was also significant because of a political alignment of authoritarian forces that emerged, noting it was no coincidence that Xi Jinping and the presidents of Russia and Turkey were seen standing so close to each other during the meetings. Our thanks to VOA's Bill Ide in Beijing for bringing us this story. Happening now in Asia, a five-story building under construction in Sri Lanka's capital collapsed Thursday, injuring at least 19 people. Police and firefighters were searching for anyone who might be trapped inside the building. The reason for the collapse was not immediately known. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for joining us. Human rights groups have condemned harsh prison sentences and called for the release of three Lao migrant workers who posted critical comments on social media and joined a protest outside the Lao embassy in Thailand. The workers were sentenced in early April to prison terms of between 12 and 20 years. The International Federation for Human Rights and the Lao Movement for Human Rights said the sentences sent a chilling message across Lao civil society that the government is determined to crush the slightest sign of activism and opposition to its authoritarian rule. The migrant workers were arrested in March 2016 after returning to Laos to reapply for official documents before planning a return to Thailand. The government accuses the three of threatening national security. Andrea Giorgietta, FIDH Asia Desk Director said the arrests highlighted the Lao government's close monitoring of citizens abroad.
He showed that the government of Laos went out of its way to persecute those three dissidents who were actually based in Thailand. And he shows that the government is also stepping up online monitoring of its citizens, because those three had expressed their opinions and their criticism of the government policy.
The U.S.-based non-governmental organization Freedom House, in its assessment of the civil liberties and media rights, classifies Laos as not free, with lower or zero ratings on political rights and liberties. Phil Robertson, Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, said the migrant workers had taken advantage of the relative freedom they had experienced in Thailand to criticize the Lao authorities.
There's a complete lack of transparency and accountability within the Lao judicial system, which you see when, you know, people don't have access to lawyers, trials are conducted in secret, families are only informed well afterwards of the results of proceedings against their loved ones.
The verdicts add to a list of arrests and forced disappearances of activists and protesters who have been critical of issues ranging from land disputes to allegations of corruption and abuse of power. The high-profile disappearance in December 2012 of well-known civil society leader Sombath Somphon, after he was seen being arrested at a police checkpoint, remains unresolved amid calls for transparency in that case. Shamali Guttal, a spokesperson for the Sombath Initiative, said harsh sentencing by authorities in Laos has been ongoing over several years, as regional governments also look to tighten controls over social media.
And I think this is a trend in Laos, for sure. It's been going on for a very long time, of course, because there is no critical discussion publicly about policy, about, you know, governance, about the way the affairs of the state and society are conducted. So yes, that's been going on, but it's also part of this trend in the region.
Other cases include the 2009 detention of a group of men and women planning to participate in pro-democracy demonstrations in Laos, while in 2007 an outspoken critic of Chinese-sponsored agricultural products also disappeared. Details for this story were gathered by Ron Corbin in Bangkok, and our thanks to him. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. More than 80 girls went on a hunger strike in northern India to protest the harassment they faced on the way to school. The teenagers from grades 9 and 10 ended the strike after 8 days. The girls said they were harassed by young men on motorbikes as they walked or cycled to school every day. You have the latest stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, Ivy Tung Lee came to the United States when she was 7 years old, and she's lived here as an undocumented immigrant ever since. She is a dreamer. That's a term that people in the United States use to describe people who grew up in America but were brought here illegally by their parents. The DREAM Act is a legislative proposal that would provide a multi-phase process for illegal immigrants in the United States to first grant conditional residency and, upon meeting further qualifications, permanent residency. DREAM is an acronym for Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors. On today's Asians in America, Ivy talks about her fears of being deported with VOA Asia's Ali Ogden, and she also tells us what life has been like living in the United States as an illegal immigrant.
I applied for DACA under the Obama administration. When election happened, my first thought is, I've given every little bits of details I've ever known about my residency in America, to now the current administration that has everything. And so there are 750,000 of DACA recipients, and every single day we're thinking about what would happen next. Would DACA still be valid? Because the truth is, it could be taken away with a stroke of a pen, and our work permit, our protection to stay in this country, could easily disappear.
For those of our viewers who don't know what DACA is an executive order that Obama signed. It was never passed by Congress, so it did not become legislation, but DACA was an executive order that gave certain rights to people to be in this country. What else did DACA provide you with?
DACA gave me a 9-digit number that made use of everything I've learned in school, and it gave me hope and a meaningful existence here. I think a lot of people that I've met who are still today in the shadows have trouble talking about their stories because there's a sense of shame. There's a sense of shame that comes with the lack of paper that is validates your value in this country.
We at the Voice of America don't advocate for one position or another. As a news organization, we do remain neutral. But, you know, of course, you know the point of view out there that there are a lot of people in this country that think you should be deported. What is your reaction to that, or what would you want to tell those people?
We are tearing families apart. We're tearing families apart who have children who are U.S. citizens, and their parents are being torn apart from them. That is not an American value.
Well, I was sitting here listening to your story, Ivy, and I was wondering if you feel scared.
I am scared every day, and I speak for many, many who are scared because of the rhetorics in this administration. And I know of parents who are afraid to take their kids to school. I know people who are afraid to go to the doctor even though they're sick, because they're thinking that when they go to a doctor, some of the information may be leaked to the government.
That it's certainly a different political climate than it was under the Obama administration. I'm curious if you have a plan B if anything should happen.
Plan B is so far away from me because I haven't been back to Macau since I was 7. I don't have any friends there. And this is my home, and I can't emphasize that enough. This is the place where I learned every life skills I need. I pledged the same flag and sing the Star Spangled Banner, and if I didn't tell anyone, they wouldn't think or assume that I am undocumented. I think that speaks volume to the inaccuracy there is out there about undocumented immigrants. I hope that in the future, I don't really need to think of a plan B. And for right now, we are here to stay, and that's exactly what we're going to do.
Ivy Tung Lee spoke with us during a Facebook Live event a short time ago on the VOA Rooftop TV set. You may see the full interview with our own Ali Ogden on the VOA Asia Facebook page. Developing at this hour in Asia, the Trump administration says it might send between 3,000 to 5,000 additional U.S. troops to Afghanistan to try to break a stalemate in the 15-year war against the Taliban. Administration officials say Trump is likely to discuss a troop increase when he attends a NATO summit later this month. All the big stories are on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, despite all the health warnings, smoking in many places is still, quote, the thing to do. But for folks who have made the smart choice not to poison themselves, but want to hang out with their smoking friends, a French design group has just the thing. It's called the Siflu, and it lets people act like they're smoking and teaches them how to breathe. VOA's Kevin Enix reports that it can be used without the nagging worry about the side effects of cancer and a shortened lifespan.
Call it a healthy fashion accessory. This is Le Siflu pipe, as modeled by these two French hipsters standing between two artists.
On the design level, it is cool. It's small, it's practical, it's good. Yeah.
No, I find it pretty. It's delicate, it's dainty.
But it is not just form. It is functional, according to its creator.
Alors, c'est tout simple. On inspire par le nez.
So it is very simple. You breathe through your nose. Why? Because it stimulates your neurotransmitters. Because it is through there that you have to inhale, and you blow into the tube. And you try to blow as long as you can, in the same rhythm. So the sound helps to maintain a constant exhalation, and that will progressively teach us to lengthen our breathing, to take awareness of our breathing, and to reach the end of your breath.
What the pipe gives users is breathing lessons without any hint of nicotine, and it does not emit dangerous secondhand smoke. It is more a work of art than anything else, but valuable for people who are trying to quit smoking or just want something to hold on to when they are hanging around their smoking friends. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
Well, one of the most glamorous and longest-lasting venues from Hollywood's golden age, Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, is now celebrating its 90th birthday. As VOA Asia's David Berg tells us, there's a lot more to the movie palace than just the star's footprints in the cement sidewalk.
One of the indications of success in Hollywood is to be invited to impress your handprint in the cement of Sid Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Sid Grauman opened what is now known as the TCL Chinese Theater on May 18, 1927. That was 2 years before the first Academy Awards were handed out. Through the decades, a galaxy of Hollywood stars have appeared on its screen and in the cement in front of the building. King Kong premiered there. So did The Wizard of Oz in 1939. George Lucas brought R2-D2 and C-3PO along for the premiere of Star Wars in 1977. Purple Rain had its premiere there, as did Titanic and Avatar. Levi Tinker is the current general manager of the Movie Palace.
It is actually the only single-screen theater in the country to be open 9 decades, completely as a first-run movie theater from the time it opened its doors through today, and continuously showing first-run movies on a daily basis.
The theater looks like a Chinese temple with marble carvings, a pagoda-shaped roof, and 2 huge Heaven's Dogs sculptures out front. Levi Tinker says Sid Grauman wanted to give audiences an escape, a place to get away from the real world and submerge themselves in the fantasies of the movies.
So he spared no expense in getting the best artists, best designers, and even importing elements from China. He had to get permission from the Chinese government and U.S. government to bring over the 2 Heaven's Dogs out in front of the theater in our courtyard. The artwork in the main lobby area was hand-painted back in 1927 by Key Luke, who was a painter but also an actor as well, too.
You know them well, of course. Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell. Here they are at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood to sign their names and print their hands and feet in concrete.
The theater is also known for its forecourt, where the glittering stars of Hollywood have left their hand and foot and hoof and leg and hair, in some cases, prints. The tradition started when silent film star Norma Talmadge was walking through the court and stepped in wet cement. Sid Grauman saw it and thought it was a great promotional gimmick. Grauman's has also been the site of innovation through the decades with early attempts at widescreen projection, the first 70mm films, the first CinemaScope, and the first digital projection. The theater is also the site of the premiere of the Ridley Scott-directed space thriller Alien Covenant. Scott says that the Chinese theater is a true treasure.
It's the history. You know, Hollywood is, whichever way you look at it, think about it, it's, you know, the most important place for movies in the world. That's it.
Actor Michael Fassbender agrees.
Yeah, I mean, in general, sort of Hollywood and this whole area is, it's got the history. It's, I mean, it's sort of the beginning of film.
The city of Los Angeles has designated the theater as a historic cultural monument, and the auditorium underwent the largest renovation in its history 4 years ago to make room for stadium seating and an IMAX screen. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
A true American treasure. If you happen to be out in Hollywood, check it out. And we'd like to say a big thank you to everybody listening on Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And a special hello to the Faculty of Communication who runs the radio station. Thanks so much. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to check us out when we're not on the air on VOA Asia Facebook. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, managing editor Diane Gao. For Ali Ogden and David Byrd, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.